It's Diane. On my mind, the human face of U.S. immigration policy. NPR reporter Aarti Shahani arrived in New York as a little girl in the 1980s. For years, her family lived without legal status. When the Shahanis eventually got green cards, they thought they had achieved their American dream. But when her father mistakenly got caught up in legal trouble, they learned that for many immigrants, life in this country isn't as secure as it seems. Aarti Shahani tells her family's story in a new book titled, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. In it, she asks, who is a deserving immigrant, and how do we decide? Aarti Shahani, it's great to meet you.
It's so wonderful to be here.
This is a story about your entire family, but your father is at the heart of it. Tell us about him and his background.
Dad was pretty much a lifelong migrant, and it wasn't by choice. He was a product of the post-colonial world, globalization, the reordering of the entire world. Dad was a kid in Karachi. He was born there. And during the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947, the British left incredibly quickly. They were in a huge hurry to leave. And they divided up the land fairly haphazardly. It caused a lot of uprooting of people and families. And my father's family was among them, as was my mother's. Dad and his family fled when he was a child from the Pakistan side, what is now the Pakistan side, down to India. And from there, by the time he was a teenager, he left the subcontinent altogether to become a migrant worker in Beirut. So as a teenager into his early 20s, he was supporting his entire family of 13 back home by sending money, by working. And from there, he went on traveling throughout the Middle East and Northern Africa. He picked up French and Arabic. Ultimately, he spoke six languages. He was incredible at math. He could multiply large numbers in his head, a very smart man, very observant man. And he ended up meeting my mom in Casablanca, Morocco, which is where I was born and my siblings as well. And then we migrated to America. I actually didn't know why exactly we migrated to America until I started writing my book, Here We Are. And I asked my mom, my dad has since passed, I asked my mom a question that I think not enough of us stop to ask our parents, which is, Mom and Dad, you say we came here for a better life. What does that mean exactly? Yeah, that is such a vague term.
Great question.
Yeah.
And?
It's easily one of the hardest conversations I've had in my life, certainly one of the hardest interviews I did for this book.
Why?
Here's the setup. I told her, I was like, Mom, you always say we came here for a better life. You and Dad were stable in Morocco. You weren't fleeing persecution. You were stable as far as I know. You had jobs. Things were okay. We were housed. And you had three kids. Why would you guys choose to leave that stability and come and live in America with the three of us, overstaying tourist visas and being undocumented? That is a huge risk. And I vividly remember growing up poor. I know what my parents went through. It was hard. I mean, I'm now the age that they were when they brought us here. I can't imagine pulling off what they did. And Mom opened up to me, and she told me about a really abusive household she was dealing with in what was a joint family. Now, many people will know about joint families. You live with, you know, in-laws and relatives and whatnot. My dad's mom, my mom's mother-in-law, was a really tough lady and verbally abusive, physically threatening, but not abusive. And things happened at home such that my mom, who is one of the most resilient human beings I know, I mean, Mom just shines life. My mom told me, and I didn't know this before, my mom told me that she swallowed a bottle of white pills and tried to take her life.
Oh, dear.
Because things had gotten so bad.
Wow.
And you know, that's kind of the funny thing, Diane. It's like, even the people you're closest to, you don't know what's inside
have
of them.
Have no idea. Yeah. So they came here. Where did they land?
Well, we landed at John F. Kennedy Airport. And this to me is like the funny thing about immigrants, not just my family, is you make that entire trek across the Atlantic. It takes a lot of steam to do that. And then once you plop yourself in America, it's like you lose all your steam and you can't live much further from the airport. And so basically, we, like many immigrants who've come here, moved to a neighborhood in Queens, just, you know, not far from where we landed. Flushing, Queens specifically, zip code 11355, which is one of the most diverse zip codes in the country. And I'm incredibly proud of that fact. I think that my upbringing in a neighborhood that was basically working class United Nations gave me a front row seat into the truth about this country. As much as we talk about conflict, division, strife, we are feeling now a moment of tribalism in this country. It is activated by political leadership. As much as that is true, the fundamentals of America is actually a country that is a fusion by design.
Absolutely.
And, you know, what I'm saying is not some sort of like Hallmark greeting about, oh, we're a melting pot. I'm actually making a point about the DNA of this country, the competitive advantage of this country, the nature of this country. All you need to do is travel to other places to appreciate how absorbent America is.
When they arrived, how did your father support the family? Did your mother go to work as well?
Oh, they were both at it. Yeah, yeah. Undocumented families are rarely a, you know, one-earner household. So they were both at it. And actually, that was really, I think, a surprising and hard thing for the both of them. They probably had this impression that they're going to come to America and Dad, with all of his languages and skills, would be eaten up by the market. And he was more like eaten alive. He basically got a job shoveling snow for $4 an hour.
Wow.
Really tough for him. And he'd never been exposed to winter before, so doubly tough in that respect. Mom ended up being the main breadwinner. My mom is a seamstress, was a seamstress. She walked up and down the streets on Main Street in Flushing. She found a bridal store that was looking for a seamstress. She hadn't made Western dresses before. She'd done more of the Asian, Indian fusion kind of thing. But she hustled. She's like, yeah, I can do it. And she started being paid the equivalent of $20 an hour, which is huge for an undocumented immigrant, even today, let alone in the 1980s. And, you know, it's funny because part of what I reflect on, and here we are in the memoir, is, you know, for Dad, he was like, where have I landed? I'm in a country where the wife makes more than the husband. And, you know, like, what's going on here? And I live in a building with so many different nationalities. And he was overwhelmed by it. And I think that's because my father felt much more comfort in tradition. He believed tradition gave him stability. My mom, on the other hand, an incredibly different personality, she just ate up the upending of norms. I mean, she loved coming to America and being a totally blank slate. You know, in interviewing Mom, I actually pointed out to her that when we were kids, because she speaks also six languages, Spanish is among her best languages because she's
including English.
Oh, yeah. Both of my parents are fluent in English. Mom gravitated to Latina women, and she avoided Indian women. And I was like, Mom, you avoided Indian women.
How come?
Exactly. And I didn't buy her answer. She was kind of like, oh, no, I was busy and who our neighbors were and whatever. I was like, no, Mom, here's my theory. My theory is that you grew up feeling constantly defined and controlled by a culture that told you women have a specific role, and you hated it. And it didn't feel organic to you. And when you got to this country, you finally felt you were free. I mean, to me, it's not dissimilar how we talk about people fleeing persecution, people fleeing communism. Mom was fleeing patriarchy. And Indian women brought her back into a mold she didn't want to be in. And Mom, you know, on the record, I recorded these things. She's like, my pichkari, meaning my little one. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that that's what I did. And she's like, how funny.
What about you and your siblings and schooling?
We were all in public school, and I had a very unusual thing happen to me. I was a nerd girl, okay? But when I was in the eighth grade, my chemistry teacher in public school, you know, I went to public school, 45 students in the class, very standard American public school experience.
Sure, sure.
She tapped me and was like, Arthi, I want you to apply for this program. And it was a program called A Better Chance. And you basically take some tests, do some interviews, and they plop you into private schools, some of the best either day schools or boarding schools in the country, and you get scholarships to go and whatnot. So anyway, I did the test and I landed at the Brearley School in Manhattan. The Brearley School, just to give you a sense of what it is and continues to be and was, the Brearley School in today's terms costs a Tesla a year to attend. My parents didn't make that much money together in an entire year or even two.
Of course.
That wasn't in our budget.
Yes.
The Brearley School was right across the street from where Donald Trump sent his daughter. It was right down the block from Gracie Mansion, where the mayor was. And I remember when I was applying to this, and I was telling mom and dad, I was in the eighth grade, I was doing these applications, and I was telling them, hey, there's a special thing I've been selected for. They had totally different reactions. Dad was like, if it's free, it can't be worth anything. What is this? And the only reason he finally believed it was worth something is I mentioned the fact about Donald Trump's daughter being right next door. And he's like, because, you know, at that point, our current president was all over the local headlines. Mom, meanwhile, who's always incredibly excited about anything I do, just immediately believed it must be incredibly special. And for me, it was kind of my first exposure to leaping in this country. You know, when we talk about the American dream, what we're actually talking about is the capacity to leap. Because in many parts of the world where we come from originally, whether it's in this last generation or five before, people are stuck in a place in society.
Yes.
There's a feudal mindset or a feudal structure. You're stuck. You're not allowed to leave. You are defined by where you started. And in America, that's actually, relatively speaking, not actually the case. You have a lot of stories of people leaping because the society allows for personal redefinition more than many others. So I got that experience stepping into a hyper elite world. And meanwhile, my father, you know, I'd mentioned to you, dad shoveled snow for $4 an hour. He ended up opening a shop on the very same block where he shoveled. And that was his dream. I mean, that was his leap. And it only took him a decade.
But there was no green card.
He did have a green card by then. So what happened in my family's case is that we were undocumented. And then my mom's baby sister and her husband, who'd been naturalized U.S. citizens, sponsored us to get our green cards.
Oh, I see.
And so in a few years, my family ended up getting green cards. And so that's actually having that green card, being official now in this country, that is what enabled me to be tapped for a program where I could get a scholarship to one of the most elite schools in the entire country. That is what enabled Dad to finally put his name on paper and open up his own shop to be his own boss instead of shoveling snow for somebody else.
Now, what do you say to people who argue that you should not have been allowed to stay here under those circumstances?
Yeah, you know, I think that we came here, we overstayed visas, and it took us a handful of years to get our green cards. Today, for that same petition, I looked it up, it would be something like 22 or 23 years. So what I would say to people is America by design is a country by and for immigrants. That is actually what this country is. It is a nation state designed and built in that way. And so if you have a bunch of people without papers living here, it's because there's been a political and government failure to create and process the line to give them papers. So you know what? You don't want people to be undocumented? Create a line for them to stand on. That's what I would say. That's realistic.
When we come back, more with Arthi Shahani.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Aarti Shahani. She's an NPR correspondent based in Silicon Valley and author of the new book titled Here We Are. The event that changed your father's life. He was arrested.
Correct.
What happened?
So my dad and his little brother, my uncle, were running a wholesale electronics store, 28th Street and Broadway in Manhattan. They were selling watches and calculators. If you ever come to New York, if you ever walk by the wholesale district, you'll still see these little stores. They're dusty.
Of course.
They're mom and pop, you know. So dad was a shopkeeper. And one day I got a call. I was actually at my first job. And mom called me. I was 16 years old. And she told me that dad and my uncle had been arrested. And I was like, what are you talking about? And, you know, just for context, I was a kid who wanted to become a prosecutor when she grew up because I had the sense of the need for justice and to put away the bad guys. Turns out my father and uncle were taken to Rikers Island, which is a horrific jail in New York City. And the state was charging them with effectively being affronts for the Cali drug cartel. Now, to break down the actual mechanics of what happened, they sold watches and calculators to customers who came in with cash. Now, those customers could be from Colombia, could be from Mexico, could be from the Middle East, could be from Johannesburg, wherever the customers were from. The strip that they were working on was low-end globalization. Okay, we know about and we cover the big banks and the way that cash has moved around the world in the billions. Well, my family was involved in the tens of thousands trade, okay? The low end. And among their customers, it so happened, according to New York State, were members of the Cali drug cartel.
Oh, boy.
Now, one thing I want to explain about this case, my understanding of it has evolved so much from when I was 16 to now. When I was 16, I thought, oh, my God, my father is he like the Indian cartel member? Like, it was bad. I didn't understand it. I was ashamed. I didn't know how to deal with it. I could not ask questions. I wanted it to go away because I was already dealing with my own inordinate imposter syndrome, being the scholarship kid at a fancy school. I didn't need this too. Okay. I had to survive. Over the years, as the case evolved and dragged on, what happened was basically the defense attorneys that we hired, we went with private attorneys who ended up not fighting particularly hard. They told my dad and uncle, just plead guilty. Take an 8-month sentence. Take the 8-month sentence, because if you go to trial, you risk something called the trial penalty. Now, this is not written in the Constitution. It's how we practice the law. According to the Constitution, we have this right to trial. But in practice, if you exercise it, you will get hit with a much stiffer sentence if convicted. So, Mr. Shahani, small business owner, shopkeeper, father trying to support a family, you want to go serve 8 months and get it over with? Or you want to go to trial, pay for the cost of trial, and then if convicted, do maybe 10 or 15 years?
Wow.
What would you do? Really, what would you do?
Really?
My uncle and father accepted their pleas. And here's what we didn't know at the time of these plea deals. They call it plea bargain, right? Bargain is a key term because the justice system is not about innocence and guilt. It is about risk and reward. What can you settle for? The prosecutor wants a conviction to make their office look successful for their metrics. You want to get off with as little time as possible. Where does it meet for the bargain? Okay. Well, that 8-month sentence ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle because, in addition to the criminal justice system dealing with my father and my uncle, the federal deportation system came in and began processes of life exile. Now, it utterly confused me, and I want to be really clear about this. The immigration authorities, in their paperwork, in their media work, talk about removing criminal aliens. They don't say, oh, many of the people we're removing happen to be long-term residents, many of them green card holders, as was my father and uncle, many of them related to U.S. citizens. You know, there's a an unfortunate dishonesty where the agencies talk about the people they're deporting as aliens, outsiders, without nodding to the fact that so many of these people, my people, are connected to this country by virtue of their own families.
Of course.
It's a dishonest conversation. So anyway, Dad's situation spiraled. And as it spiraled, something shifted in me, Diane. I went from abject shame to indignation. I was like, this isn't right. It doesn't make sense. How do you keep making them pay? Yeah, they made a mistake. But at some point, you gotta stop extracting punishment from people. Today is very different from the 1990s. In the 1990s, America was really stuck in a story about being tough on crime. And I think since then, we've evolved to understand how mass incarceration has ruined so many lives. I hope that my memoir can help people understand how mass deportation is ruining many lives.
How did you manage within the classroom during this period?
It was awful.
Awful.
It was awful. I mean, like, my grades dropped pretty much immediately.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I was really sad. And I remember, because this was all happening around the time of college applications.
Huh.
I remember the end of my junior year having pretty much straight A's at Brearley. And, you know, they were like, for a scholarship kid who came in the ninth grade, wow, that's really strong showing. You know, like, you're doing really well. And then over that summer is when the legal problems unfolded and Dad was taken to Rikers. And, you know, my self-esteem was really shot. I felt constant insecurity. I stopped being able to read and to concentrate. And this is what happens with, you know, any kind of anxiety that comes at you
in
life. Of course. How do you concentrate on the page? And my grades pretty much dropped immediately.
And what about your mother?
I think that for Mom, she's someone who wants to fix things. And so it made no sense to her that, for example, when we were in court, like, Mom, she just thought she could go up to the prosecutor who was a nice Asian American lady who
and
looked like one of our neighbors.
Explain things.
Yeah, like, no, just woman to woman. Let me tell you. No, really,
course.
I promise. My mom was a community organizer. She worked in our building to make sure that there weren't drugs there. I mean, you know, Mom just wanted to tell this lady, no, really, we're on the same page. And to go into a court system and realize you're not allowed to speak, but to say innocent or guilty, you know, it was a real, it was hard for her. And I think that for her, she went from disbelief to helplessness. She ended up having more than a year of constant vomiting. You know, we all got very thin during that time.
How long was your father away from you?
Well, his jail sentence, as I had mentioned, was an 8-month sentence. By no means long by the standards we often see in the system. What was interesting about that time is that's when I actually got to know my father. In part, the memoir I've written is a front row seat into American history, contemporary history that Americans need to know right now. And in part, it's just a father-daughter story. I mean, it's like when I was growing up, Dad was either, you could say, a stranger because he was always out working. And then he came home, he smoked his Marlboros, didn't really talk. And the only time I heard from him was to complain about my skirt length. Too short. That's too short. And then, like, I got around that by wearing jeans and keeping a miniskirt in my backpack. I thought he was old world. He annoyed me. I didn't want to deal with him as I became a teenager. That's, I think, highly relatable. And then once the arrest happened, and particularly as the case unfolded, and I got to see the way he was being slammed, and I turned into it, I leaned into it, I wanted to help, I actually stopped going to school. By now I was in college. I'd graduated from Brearley, and I was at the University of Chicago. And I stopped going to school during Dad's time inside because I wanted to be nearby him. My official reason was my family needs money, and it was true. I was working, and I was making money because we needed money. But the real reason was I just needed to be as close to him as I could. And at Rikers Island, those were my dad dates. That's when I got to start learning about who he was, learning about, you know, his life as a teenager. You know, when I was I was 19 or 20 when I was visiting him at Rikers. When he was that age, he was a migrant worker in Beirut, Lebanon, sending money home to his family. So, no, in part, the book is recounting my father's life because he was part of that class of people, which I believe is unfortunately the majority, who don't get to be remembered for who they were. He was labeled in his life. He was put into legal categories that are meaningless with respect to who he actually was, and he was stuck in those. I've gotten to live a life thus far where I get recognized and praised, and that is not regular. That is not normal.
So after he finished his time, mm-hmm. then what happened?
We already knew that deportation was going to come, not because the legal system told us. There was no agency that had the courtesy of telling us. We knew it because my uncle, his little brother, had just been deported.
After he had served his time.
Correct.
His time.
My uncle served his time. He had been deported. Total surprise to us. Happened very quickly. So for Dad, knowing that it was coming, I started playing faux lawyer. I started looking around for help, emailing everyone, campaigning. I was watching Indian TV, and there was a lawyer, an immigration lawyer on Indian TV, talking about immigration issues. And I emailed him, and I summarized my dad's story. And I was like, dear lawyer, we already have green cards. Dad already has a green card. Mom's a U.S. citizen already. We don't need green cards, but my dad is going to be delegalized. And how can I stop that? My family was on the front end of a new trend in American history, a trend brought on actually under the Clinton administration, under Bill Clinton. That lawyer from Indian TV invited me to the New York City Bar Association. Now, in my fantasy life, I was going to the bar and I was just going to meet dozens of lawyers who were going to line up to help my family. And it was going to be awesome. And I was going to be like swimming in free and the best legal help. That's not what happened. I showed up at the bar. And actually, I was asked to speak publicly. It was the first time I was speaking publicly about my family situation. It was a panel of politicians. I remember Congressman Barney Frank, then Congressman Barney Frank. I had met him. He was also on that panel. The top prosecutor for the immigration agency was also on that panel. And what they were doing was discussing how the laws that Clinton signed had gone overboard and were destroying too many families. And there was bipartisan agreement, Republicans and Democrats, that we have to undo some of this automatic deportation stuff. And I was kind of the human interest voice in that room. So I spoke. I was terrified. And at the end of it, not every lawyer, I remember specifically one lawyer in that room came up to me to ask if my family needed help. As journalists, we cover and are part of political theater a lot. We know the game. We understand sort of the roles being played in a room. It touched me that she, that adult who I talked about in my book, she's a law professor at New York University, had the presence of mind to remember this is not just an issue, this is real people's lives.
People.
Yeah.
People.
And she connected me to a brilliant lawyer in New Jersey who, you know, the legal practice is not the practice of justice. It is the search for loopholes and the exploitation of those loopholes. So she found a lawyer who was amazing at reading case law quickly and analyzing and using it. He mounted this argument that my father, who could have been deported automatically exactly like my uncle was in fact not even deportable under this arcane notion of deportability. It worked. And my father was out of detention. He'd been detained by the immigration authorities within a matter of days. His case was not over. We fought his case for a decade. I had no idea it was going to last that long. I also had no idea the strain it was going to put on Dad, on me, on my family. I had to write the book in part because, Diane, by the end of it, I had a lot of guilt inside me.
Really?
For how hard I pushed us to stay here. I could not, as a child, fathom us not being together in this country. And because I couldn't fathom it, whether Dad wanted to fight or not, I needed us to stay here. And, you know, in that decade of fighting, his body, his health fell apart. He was a workaholic who was never able to return to work. Being in constant legal limbo really puts a wrench in your ability to, you know, build any kind of new business if you're an entrepreneur. Having a criminal conviction pretty much kills your ties to the people who would have talked to you before. So he went from having his sense of purpose as a human being defined by being a breadwinner to no longer having that sense of purpose. And it's something I hadn't expressed before until I wrote the book. I needed to put down on paper. Ultimately, the book was me working out, was it worth it or wasn't it?
And how did you answer that?
The way I found my answer really has to do with my father's passing. Dad was 74 when he passed. And he lived much longer than any of us expected him to, because man, did life beat him down. And he ended up holding on to life long enough so that he would not pass away abroad, but he would pass away here, beside us, here. You can live life in many places. You can only die in one. And he chose America.
He chose. Arthi, I wonder what your reaction is to the revelations that President Trump has talked about putting alligators in the water and putting spikes on top of wire fences. I mean, how do you react to that?
Honestly, I don't. This is a man who seeks attention by saying obnoxious things, shoot the migrants, grab women by the... I mean, I think that we in the media and we as citizens have to be riled up less by idiocy and keep our eyes on the prize. What I care about is that when I speak, people who are listening to us know they are heard. That I am not the only one with the experience of being a migrant in this country, leaping, living a dream, my loved one living a nightmare. Plenty of people have had that experience, and we are America. And so I'd rather focus on the truth of who we are than the dumb stuff people tweet or say to get attention.
Arthi Shahani, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urib-Lipker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.